The Iowa Arts Showcase is Iowa Public Radio's monthly performing arts program devoted to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. While 2015 is wrapping up, the Iowa arts scene is revving up with the holiday season. For December, we'll get the latest scoop on the Heartland Marimba Festival's Holiday Spectacular Winter Concert Tour. We'll applaud as Iowa State Center proudly recognizes 35 years of fabulous Nutcracker performances. We'll hear about the Gallagher Blue Dorns, a big band Christmas concert featuring Bill and Nola Rose Shepherd. We'll catch up with Iowa's own Texas tenor John Hagen as the Cowboy Trio prepares to join forces with the Des Moines Symphony to celebrate New Year's Eve. And we'll see how the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's guest director, James Marvel, is preparing to grab audiences with their upcoming production of Verdi's La Traviata. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase. Thanks for joining us.
The great music that's in this opera is just absolutely nonstop from start to finish. I think that this is one of the most frequently performed operas in the world, and it's performed that often for a very good reason. Its music is just absolutely transporting. The story is fantastic, and every aspect of it is just a director's dream. And I think that if you've never been to an opera before, you should come to La Traviata. I think that, you know, sometimes people think that opera isn't for me, or it's something that only hoity-toity people do, or you know, something like that. But the main thing to remember is that opera was written for the people. It was a popular art form. You know, the day after, you know, La Donna Immobile from Rigoletto was premiered, I mean, it was the song that was sung in all the streets. It's the tune that took over the entire city. So even if you like rock and roll music, country music, jazz, whatever it happens to be, when you have the opportunity to witness one of the truly great people in a given art form, whether that's a certain jazz musician or something like that, you should go. And I think that this opera is the most often performed opera in the world for a reason. And it's because the music is outstanding and the dramatic qualities of it are great as well. And if you don't speak Italian, all of the super titles, all of the words in English are projected above the stage. If you've never been to an opera, this is a great, great starter opera that will ensure that you fall in love with the art form for years to come.
Director of Opera at the University of Tennessee at Knoxville, James Marvel. In 2008, with the Juilliard Opera Center, James made his first appearance at Lincoln Center with James Conlon. In 2011, he made his Carnegie Hall debut with Katie Tucker's video production of Carmina Burana. And over the past 19 years, he has directed over 100 critically acclaimed productions and groundbreaking new creations in major opera houses and theaters around the globe. In January, James will be guest directing the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's production of Verdi's La Traviata. James fills us in on the historical background of one of Verdi's most praised works.
You know, many people refer to La Traviata as Verdi's most personal opera. And I think what they mean by that is that when Verdi's wife passed away, very shortly thereafter, both of his children passed away. And so it was a really sort of difficult period in his life, although thereafter he met soprano Giuseppina Strapponi, who became his life partner moving forward. And they never did marry officially, but they did live together for the rest of their natural lives. And so to a certain extent, I feel as though the subject matter in La Traviata, although she was certainly not a courtesan, they were sort of living by their own standards on a certain level, you could say. And the author, Alexandre Dumas, the son, the opera is based on his novel, Camille, The Lady of the Camellias, was actually based on a courtesan who lived in Paris. And her name was Marguerite Duplessis, and she was the partner of the author Alexandre Dumas, the son, and also of the composer Franz Liszt. And she was known and renowned for her beauty, although she died at a very young age. She died at the age of 23. So I think that in writing this opera, Giuseppe Verdi was extremely busy at this period in his life. He had just opened a very popular, well-received production in Venice at the La Fenice, very famous La Fenice Theater. So he was working on Il Trovatore at the time. He was working on Rigoletto. He was receiving all these commissions, and he signed an additional contract. He was commissioned to write another opera that was due to be performed only 2 years later. And although he had not yet settled on a subject matter for the opera, so you can imagine the amount of pressure that must have been mounting at that time. And Verdi and Giuseppina Strepponi saw a play version of the Dumas novel in Paris, and he immediately knew that that was the opera that he wanted to write, and did so. And I think that one of the interesting things about Dumas as a person and as a novelist and playwright himself, he was the son of Alexandre Dumas Sr., the father who had written such books as The Three Musketeers, The Count of Monte Cristo. He was an extremely celebrated author, although the son was born of an illegitimate relation. Well, the relationship wasn't illegitimate, but he would have been considered an illegitimate child. And so these kinds of social issues were of considerable importance to Dumas, the son. He even wrote a play called The Illegitimate Son. He wrote plays, one of which was called The Demi-Monde, which is essentially the society in Paris at the time where the very, very wealthy would have these sort of kept women on the side. And demi-monde means the half-world. It's sort of the world that exists, but that's not entirely acknowledged openly in public. And so not only were Dumas' novels and plays considered to be rather, well, they were titillating, but to the same extent, they were frequently censored or banned and things like that. And I found it interesting that Giuseppe Verdi chose to set this particular opera to music, and yet I feel it's his most personal opera and my personal favorite of all of his 20-something operas.
The Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's guest director, James Marvel. James talks about La Traviata's stunning music.
This particular opera is laden with a multitude of examples of arias and ensemble pieces that are readily recognizable. The Libiamo, which is the drinking song that takes place in Act One, celebrating the ability of champagne to wash away all of life's cares, is one of the most celebrated pieces in all of opera and is performed regularly at donor events and other kinds of things that opera companies produce and put on. There's obviously Violetta's very famous aria, Sempre Libera, which is, I'm always free, I won't be constrained by love, I'm going to be free and nobody's going to own me. Alfredo has a variety of beautiful, beautiful arias. Il mio rimorso is a very angry aria, actually. Act 3 has some really wonderful music. The gypsies and the matador choruses are always a major crowd favorite. And I think the fight scene in Act 3 is particularly gripping, both musically and dramatically. And then, of course, in Act 4, you have Violetta's Addio del Passato, where she is dying, essentially, of consumption and almost has no energy. I mean, she's just broken, and yet she reedifies in that moment that she finds this comfort in God's forgiveness. And I think the ensemble writing at the end of Act 4, once the father returns and Alfredo is there, the great music that's in this opera is just absolutely nonstop from start to finish.
The director of opera at the University of Tennessee at Knoxville, James Marvel. James will be guest directing the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's production of Verdi's La Traviata. The Cedar Rapids Opera Theater, with members of Orchestra Iowa, will be presenting La Traviata on Friday, January 15th at 8 p.m., and again on Sunday afternoon at 2 at the Paramount Theater in Cedar Rapids. Tickets will be available at orchestraiowa.org or at the door. For more details about the production, please go to cr-opera.org. On January 2nd at 7 p.m., the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's La Traviata performers will present a free concert at the Temple Judah in Cedar Rapids. To find out more about James Marvel, please see his website at jamesmarvel.com. To hear more from James's interview, please go to the drop-down classical menu and click on the Iowa Arts Showcase link of our website at iowapublicradio.org. The University of Iowa Opera will present opera scenes tonight at 7:30 at the Coralville Center for the Arts. On December 10th, the a cappella vocal ensemble Kalmus performs at Drake's Cheslow Auditorium. Just ahead, we'll hear about the Iowa State Center's 35-year Nutcracker Ballet tradition. We'll enjoy learning about the Gallagher Blue Dorns' Big Band Christmas event with Bill Shepherd and singer-songwriter Nola Rose Shepherd. We'll learn about the Des Moines Symphony's New Year's Eve Pops with the Texas Tenors. And we'll see what the Heartland Marimba Festival's artistic director, Matthew Cawley, reveals about their holiday spectacular winter concert tour. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase.
We really just want to become an important and interesting part of the cultural landscape in Iowa, so we're hoping that you'll help us out with that.
The Heartland Marimba Festival's artistic director, Matthew Cawley. The Heartland Marimba Festival has already hit the road this month to present their holiday spectacular program, chock full of winter holiday favorites. The trio will also be performing on an unusual percussion instrument.
This is an instrument I've had in my arsenal of instruments for maybe about 6 years now. I originally purchased this from an instrument maker in Maine, Jim Doble, who makes glass xylophones and many other kind of exotic percussion instruments. He made this for me for a couple projects. I was doing one with dance and electronic media, and all the music was produced on glass instruments. And then I was also commissioning a concerto from a composer with a lot of glass instruments involved. And so that was primarily why I had this instrument. But when I was thinking about the Christmas show, I really was looking for some sounds that might kind of take it into that magical Christmas time place. And so the glass xylophone was first to come to mind, along with many other instruments like the glockenspiel. And then we're going to use some other percussion instruments like sleigh bells and wind chimes and things like that as well. So the glass xylophone was an addition. It's not a traditional keyboard percussion instrument, and the bars are made of glass, whereas the marimba has wooden keys on it. But it fits within what we do as percussionists, and we thought it would be a nice addition to the sound palette for the holidays.
Well, tell us about the folks you're going to be on tour with.
For the holiday spectacular tour that we're doing, I'm collaborating with two marimba players from the University of Iowa. They're doctoral students there, Andrew Veit and Wanapa Yanovut. And Andrew toured with us this summer in June for our six-city concert tour. And he's also one of our board members, as we're working to incorporate as a nonprofit organization. And so we're just touring as a trio, and we're playing a lot of music and a lot of notes as a trio. So we're really working on making a special concert.
Tell us about some of the pieces that you're going to be performing on this holiday tour.
We will do a nice variety of pieces. We're going to open with a Nutcracker Suite And this was a piece that I was able to find already made and arranged for a marimba trio. And that's part of the mission of the Marimba Festival, is to showcase a lot of the repertoire that we have, but also to generate new repertoire. So we're using some things that have already been arranged by other marimba players and composers. So this is one, the Nutcracker Suite. We'll also do some pieces from a collection that was arranged by another marimbist, Nathan Daltrey. This collection is called the Yuletide Marimbist. And it's a really nice collection of unique arrangements of very familiar tunes like O Come All You Faithful and Away in a Manger, the First Noel. And that involves marimba with some glass xylophone and other percussion instruments. We're also arranging our own version of A Christmas Fantasy, which is originally for organ, by a composer named W.T. Best. And it's A Christmas Fantasy on English Christmas Carols. And that's a fun piece because it's kind of coming from a different compositional approach. It's a romantic piece that Best has written in the 19th century that we're arranging. And then we're also doing a selection of other pieces like Sleigh Ride and Frosty the Snowman and some Romanian Christmas songs that Béla Bartók put together from his ethnomusicological studies through Eastern Europe and things like that. So it'll be, I think, a wide variety that a lot of people will be able to connect to.
So you have two concerts left in your festival, and one of them is today, this afternoon at 5 p.m. Tell us about that concert and where it's going to be.
Yes, today we're going to perform at the Waterloo Center for the Arts in Waterloo. And that one will be a 5 o'clock concert, followed by a reception or a Christmas party right in their cafe outside of the theater. And we will be in the art gallery. And then a couple of weeks after that, we're going to perform in Iowa City at a new space called Public Space One. And it's, I think, primarily an art gallery that opens its doors for performing groups and for bands and music groups to do concerts. And so I'm really happy about the different spaces that we're performing in, because that's a big part of what I wanted the festival to be exploring, is getting in the community in many different kind of venues and not just performing at universities or, you know, one kind of space.
And that concert is on December 18th in Iowa City, and it starts at 7 p.m.
Yes.
So how can folks get more information about the Heartland Marimba Festival?
Well, you can find us online and in many places at our website at heartlandmarimbafestival.com. You can also sign up for our newsletter. If you go to tinyletter.com/Heartland Marimba Festival, that'll get you right to the place that you can just type in your email and then you'll get all the updated information. We also have a Facebook page and an Instagram account at Heartland Marimba Festival. And you can find me on Twitter and all those other places on Facebook. And I forgot to mention, we have a YouTube page as well, and we have a recording of our marimba orchestra performance from the Heartland Marimba Festival last summer, if you're interested in seeing what 25 marimbas sound like.
The Heartland Marimba Festival's artistic director, Dr. Matthew Colley. To hear more from Matthew's interview, please go to the drop-down classical menu and click on the Iowa Art Showcase link on our website at iowapublicradio.org. Don't go away. Band leader, conductor, and trombonist Bill Shepherd shares details about his Big Band Christmas performance with singer-songwriter Nola Shepherd at UNI's Gallagher Bluedorn. The Texas Tenors make their Des Moines Symphony debut, wowing audience members on New Year's Eve. And a classic holiday fairy tale comes to life as Iowa State Center celebrates its 35th anniversary of first-class Nutcracker Ballet performances. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
Well, Richard Snyder, Dick Snyder, was the first director of the Iowa State Center. At least he was the first one that I worked with, and I think he was the original director. He was in Tammy Kulbeck's position now. He has a daughter that was a ballet dancer, and he'd done Nutcrackers, two of them actually, at C.Y. Stevens with the Des Moines Ballet. Mary Joyce Lind was the directress at that point. By the time I came on the scene, probably in 1979, they'd gone different ways. Des Moines was down there and Richard was up in Ames, and he had hired the Pittsburgh Ballet Theater to come to Ames to perform the Nutcracker 2 performances. And he gave me, Yoko and I, tickets to go see it. And so we did, and it was sold out. I mean, two performances sold out, which we thought, wow, this is great. We were all excited about that. Both Miyoko and I had been involved in a lot of Nutcrackers. He also then invited us to the cast party, which all the company was there. And we were enjoying the party and eating crackers and drinking adult beverages and so on and so forth. And I said, you know, we could do our own Nutcracker here, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I think he'd been waiting for that moment because he escorted me immediately away into the kitchen, which is kind of private. Popped another Heineken's, and he said, okay, tell me what you got in mind. And so I pitched him on the Nutcracker, and I said, I think we could probably do one. If you give us 2 years to train the dancers, we could have a group ready to do the Nutcracker. After that, I forgot about it. I went home. I thought it was party talk. By Wednesday, he sent me a formal letter from the Iowa State Center saying, I want to get together with you. I want to flesh this out. I'd like to do this. So he took it from there. I mean, it just went on a whirlwind trip. Richard arranged for costumes, Richard arranged for financing, Richard arranged for people to do the sets. Richard took care of everything. We basically worked for him from that point forward. We took 18 months to create the dancers, but we created all the dancers here, plus auditioned for other young professional dancers and people in the area that would be suitable to do the Nutcracker. In those days, point was not a huge issue. Most of the point dancers were our own, although Janice Baker, who's present, was one of the original Spanish and also in the snow. Ellen Mullen was, of course, she was our dancer, but she was a Dewdrop fairy. But most of the original dancers, point dancers, were from our own studio, although not all of them, or young, kind of young professional dancers in the area, semi-professional dancers in the area. And there was maybe 24 point dancers. And so we cast the whole thing with those dancers plus community children, community adults. Everything was done with our own dancers and with the help of Des Moines Ballet. Debbie Hyatt was also our sugar plum fairy at that time, and Doug Moss was one of our boys here. So it was all totally a personal production put on by herself. We used about 87 dancers and did two performances, and it was a big success, and from that point we just kept rolling along.
It was wonderful. It was wonderful to be on that stage. It was wonderful to be part of something new and fresh. It was a very exciting time.
Yeah, I remember vividly learning that we were going to be doing it and thinking that that was quite the slice of heaven that we had the privilege to have in Ames, Iowa. Never quite imagined being able to do that. There's something just magical about it.
Three of the ballet movers and shakers who made Iowa State Center's 35-year tradition of presenting Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker Ballet a reality. You heard from artistic co-director and Act One choreographer, and among many posts, a former assistant ballet master and dancer with the Joffrey Ballet, Iowa native Robert Thomas. Iowa State's assistant professor in dance and Nutcracker stager for Act One to Snow, who wrangles the raucous boys and charts out the battle scenes, who also serves as a dancer, director, teacher, and represented Iowa at the Special Arts Iowa at an international festival held at the Kennedy Center, Janice Baker. And ISU senior lecturer of management in the College of Business, ballet mistress for Iowa Youth Ballet, and ISU's Nutcracker Ballet mistress and cast coordinator, Ames native Dr. Ellen Mullen. Janice and Ellen danced in the Iowa State Center's first Nutcracker Ballet performance. Janice danced Spanish and as a snowflake, and Ellen danced the role of the Dewdrop Fairy. Absent from the Nutcracker Quartet was artistic co-director and Act Two and Snow choreographer, who danced with the Metropolitan Opera Ballet, was soloist with the Harkness Ballet Company, and danced many leading roles with such respected companies as the Joffrey Ballet and dancers like Alvin Ailey, Jerome Robbins, and Agnes DeMille, dancer Miyoko Kato. Miyoko and Robert were married in 1971. Eventually, they co-founded the Robert Thomas Dance Centers of Ames. Together, they have trained over 10,000 dancers and were instrumental in establishing ISU's Nutcracker Ballet tradition. The original ISU Nutcracker Ballet performance started with 87 dancers. Now the show boasts over 287 dancers from 30 Central Iowa studios. Robert, Janet, and Ellen talk about how Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker became so popular in America.
In 1950, I think it was on the Ed Sullivan Show. Before that, the Nutcracker wasn't really a holiday ballet. It wasn't really even a Christmas ballet. It was just a ballet. But in 1950, it appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show, and for some reason or other, the American public took a real like to it. It was a Balanchine staging of the Nutcracker, and it became a holiday tradition. There's like 1,000 Nutcrackers produced around the country this time of the year, and it seems to just keep coming back over and over again. It's part of the tradition of that holiday season. It starts right after Thanksgiving and goes all the way almost until New Year's.
Oh, I love just the musical score. I think the score is timeless. And then the dancing is just that extra bonus. So it's that timeless score. It's the Velveteen Rabbit underscore of, even though it's broken, it's still precious. I think that's a really big life lesson. We're all broken somehow, but we're all really precious. And then, you know, validating that and the magic of dreaming and going to exotic places and meeting new people and finding their different ways. There's so many like sub themes in that story that it appeals to everyone. The season is one of great kindness and appreciation, and it seems to track with the ballet story. So,
Tchaikovsky wrote 4 great waltzes, and each one got progressively better and better and better. And the Nutcracker was the 4th one. The Waltz of the Flowers was considered his greatest waltz. Granted, Strauss invented the waltz, created the waltz, but Tchaikovsky took it to heights that had never been before and it's never been surpassed. The Waltz of the Flowers is known everywhere. You hear it in grocery stores, and you're just carried away by the swells of that particular piece of music. And that was his greatest waltz, and I think it's significant of the whole period. Other parts that I like now at the Iowa State Center is the snow scene. When the snow blows, I watch it from the front, and it's gotten to the point where it looks like a real blizzard, and it's just very beautiful, because that music is very special and beautiful as well. The music, as Jenna says, is just fabulous. It just makes you dance. It's hard to sit in your seat when you sit and watch that particular ballet.
I had the privilege of being the Dewdrop Fairy, and we had just a delightful time. There's just something about the community of people, and it's been that way since the very first Nutcracker, and it continues to be that way today. We have a camaraderie that it's hard to quite describe how magical it is. And we don't rehearse really for that many weeks before we actually perform, and it's always miraculous how that happens, but it's just simply magic that happens.
Artistic co-director and Act One choreographer Robert Thomas, Iowa State's assistant professor in dance and Nutcracker stager for Act One to Snow, Janice Baker, an ISU senior lecturer of management in the College of Business, and Nutcracker ballet mistress and cast coordinator Ellen Mullen. The 4th Nutcracker Musketeer and 35-year artistic co-director is Miyoko Kato Thomas. Performances for the 35th Annual Nutcracker Ballet will be on Saturday, December 12th at 1:30 and 7:30 p.m., and again on Sunday, December 13th at 1:30 p.m. at the Iowa State Center. For tickets, go to Ticketmaster.com. Joy Volker will be dancing the role of the Sugar Plum Fairy. Performing as the Cavalier will be Raymond Gaetan. To hear more from Robert, Janice, and Ellen's interview, please go to the drop-down classical menu and click on the Iowa Arts Showcase link on our website at iowapublicradio.org. Other Nutcracker performances include Ballet Quad Cities with Orchestra Iowa, performing the Nutcracker at the Paramount in Cedar Rapids this weekend and at the Adler in Davenport next weekend. Ballet Des Moines is presenting the Nutcracker December 10th through the 13th at Hoyt Sherman Place. And the Dubuque City Youth Ballet will present the Nutcracker at the Grand Opera House in Dubuque on December 12th and 13th, and also the 18th through the 20th. Just ahead, the Texas Tenors join the Des Moines Symphony for a sizzling New Year's Eve concert. And Bill and Nola Shepherd present a swinging big band Christmas program at the Gallagher Blue Dorn. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase.
I like big band music a lot because of the harmonies that are used. I like it because they use sections of instruments. Like in this concert, there will be five saxophones, and there'll be four trombones and four trumpets and drum, bass, and piano. And to me, that's such a different sound than the electronic music that we hear today. And it's not to say today's music isn't fine, so... The thing that makes it cool to me is the sound. To me, the sound of all those instruments together is a fabulous sound and can only be reproduced and produced by having those instruments play.
Big band leader, professional musician, educator, and author Bill Shepherd. Bill started teaching in the Ohio public schools. He took a year off to play in the newly formed Tommy Dorsey Band under Tommy's successor, Warren Covington. Eventually, he started teaching on the collegiate level. In 1976, he came to UNI as their symphonic and marching band director. He still serves as an instructor of music and general studies at UNI. In Iowa, he started his own Bill Shepherd Big Band, the Bill Shepherd Combo, the Red Hot Dixieland Jazz, and Shepherd's Flock. He also took over directing the Waterloo Municipal Band and started a New Horizons Band. During his tenure as big band leader, he recorded four discs. The last two are Christmas recordings with singer and songwriter Nola Shepherd. Nola started singing in her dad's bands when she was in high school. She spent 2 years at UNI and finished her songwriter degree at Berklee School of Music in Boston. She released an original CD called Nola with singer-songwriter Jim Queeley. Bill fills us in on the definition of big band music.
Well, part of it, I think, is a time period. We associate the big band period with pre-World War II and after World War II. What makes a big band is usually a sax section, a trumpet section, a trombone section, oftentimes a singer. And the way the music is written and the music that's chosen, I guess maybe one way to say it would be the music from the Great American Songbook. Like, you know, the great songwriters of that time period.
And in addition to the big band, part of this movement also included this development of an added vocalist to the group.
Yes. Originally, the big bands were all instrumental. And then they begrudgingly had a singer sing a tune or two. And the band leaders soon realized that the people dancing really liked hearing a singer. So it evolved from sort of begrudgingly letting somebody sing a tune with the band to writing arrangements especially for their singers. And I suppose one of the most famous of that kind of singing was done by Frank Sinatra. He started out with Harry James and then moved to Tommy Dorsey. And he was the Elvis Presley of his time. And it's incredible that this guy sang and recorded for five generations. It's just mind-blowing how much recording he did. And also, he was a movie star. So people that never heard him sing would see him on the screen. I guess his greatest role was in From Here to Eternity. And I think he won an Oscar for that. So yeah, he was in many, many movies as well as being a singer.
Well, let's talk about your concert on the afternoon of December 19th. And tell us about the musicians that you're going to have. Tell us who the combo members are. And then also tell us about some of the folks that are in your band.
Really, it's an all-star lineup of musicians from this area. The saxophone section, we'll start out with them. Of course, longtime saxophone player in the area, Bob Schaefer. Chris Mertz, who's our Jazz One director. Tom Barry is a great tenor player. Kevin Drow is going to play Barry Sax. And the trumpet section, Randy Grabowski, who is a fantastic trumpet player, who has played in Las Vegas and actually has played for Sinatra. Also, we have Kyle Engelhardt and Gerald Ramsey, who are both band directors at Cedar Falls High School. And not only are they excellent band directors, they're excellent trumpet players. In this concert, we'll have Anthony Williams, who is our new trombone teacher at UNI, Brent Mead, who is one of our students, and Bard Mackey, who taught in the Cedar Falls schools for many years, has played in the symphony for many years, and he'll be playing bass trombone. Bob Washett will be playing piano, Dennis Johnson on drums. Our new bass teacher, I don't have his name at my fingertips, he's a Russian fellow, great bass player. So these are some of the people that will be on stage playing. This band is as good as any of the name bands that would have been touring back when I was on the road.
Tell us about the concert.
I can tell you the very first thing is going to be me singing Let It Snow, Let It Snow. Then, in no particular order, Silver Bells, Deck the Halls, There's No Place Like Home for the Holidays, Christmas Time is Here, Jolly Old St. Nicholas, Here Comes Santa Claus, It's a Marshmallow World. And we're going to do a big band sing-along at the end of the concert, so everybody in the audience can get a little Christmas spirit by singing. They'll be accompanied by the band, so that should be a fun time.
And it had to be you. You're singing that one.
I should have said this also. It's a Christmas concert, but I had done concerts before, and at the intermissions, people said, well, how about playing just some big band stuff? And I said, oh, glad to. So we'll do a few big band tunes. Like, I know Nola's going to end the first half with Please Don't Talk About Me When I'm Gone. And we'll do, of course, Glenn Miller's In the Mood and Glenn Miller's Moonlight Serenade. And It Had to Be You was made popular once again by Harry Connick Jr. And it's a great big band vocal tune.
Don't Take Your Love From Me was one of the combo tunes. And Christmas in Cedar Falls.
Nola wrote that one for the last concert I did.
And this one, I'm Beginning to See the Light.
Yeah, that's a great old Harry James tune. And the combo will be the rhythm section and myself and Chris Mertz. And I hope that the people will come and support the concert because it's for a really good cause to help Gallagher Bluedorn. And also it will let us know that there are people out there who like big band music, want to support it, and want to hear something they're not going to hear anywhere else.
Big band leader, professional musician, educator, and author Bill Shepherd. The Gallagher Bluedorn Swingin' a Big Bang Christmas featuring the Bill Shepherd Big Band with local professional musicians and Bill's daughter, singer-songwriter Nola Rose Shepherd, will be held in the Great Hall on Saturday, December 19th at 2 p.m. The band's bass player is Alex Pershunin. For more info and tickets, go to gbpac.com. To hear more from Bill's interview, please go to the drop-down classical menu and click on the Iowa Arts Showcase link on our website at iowapublicradio.org. On December 11th at 7:30 p.m., as part of the Hanter Artist Series, the Ellis Marcellus Quartet will be performing at the Englert in Iowa City. Don't go away. Cowboy boots and hats are optional with the Texas Tenor's debut performance on New Year's Eve with the Des Moines Symphony. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase.
better not pout. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is going. Santa Claus is leaving. Santa Claus is coming.
It's so fun for us to be in Iowa, and the guys love Iowa. And of course, Marcus has ties to Iowa, and JC always likes to say, I wasn't born in Iowa, I didn't go to school in Iowa, but I love Iowa. Every time I visit it, I love it. But it is so much fun to come back here because the support we got during the show and that we've had ever since has been tremendous, and the people of Iowa are so kind and supportive, and the organizations have been the same, and we really feel that. So we love to come back here and share what we're doing with the people in Iowa.
Iowa's own Texas tenor, John Hagen. Marcus Collins also has Iowa connections. He did part of his schooling at Drake University and Indian Hills Community College. JC graduated from Wichita State. John shares background on how the trio got together.
Marcus and JC go back as friends longer than I do with either of them. They met on a cruise ship, and it's probably been, 16, 17 years ago, and they were cast in a production cast on Celebrity Cruises together, and so they spent 2 years cruising the world together and living in very tight quarters and became fast friends, and it's also during that period of time when Marcus's father passed, so they have a real bond. They went through a lot of stuff together, and, you know, Marcus has a lot of ties, actually, to Iowa. He was born in Iowa, didn't live here a long time, was raised a while, then they moved around. They were in Florida and Texas and several other places, but he has real ties to Des Moines. He came back there and lived for several years, worked at, I think it's the Science Center of Iowa in the education area, and then he did 2 seasons at the Ingersoll Dinner Theater. And he has a sister that lives in West Des Moines, and he's very excited to come back to Des Moines, and a lot of friends. He went to high school in, I believe it was Seymour, Iowa, which is southern Iowa, and he's got lots of friends and family, and he's really excited about it, as am I. JC grew up in a cattle ranch in Missouri. Really didn't get involved a lot in music until he was in high school. It's like one of those great stories from Glee where he was on the basketball team, heard the national anthem being sung, you know, every time they had a game, and wasn't all that enamored with it, and thought, well, I can do that. So he did it 1 week, and the next week he and his 4 buddies did it, who were also on the basketball team, and then he got the bug for being involved with music, and the rest is history, as they say.
And tell us about yourself, John.
Well, I grew up in Waverly, Iowa. Of course, my parents were both music teachers at Waverly High School and at Wartburg College. And so I guess I never escaped the music bug, thankfully. I went to school down here at UNI, and very grateful for everything I learned here. It's served me well out in the professional world.
And you've done some teaching around as well.
Yeah, I actually filled in here at UNI for somebody on sabbatical, and then I also taught at Wartburg off and on for several years. That's something I've always really enjoyed. I always feel like my best singing happens when I'm teaching, too.
So then how did you run into Marcus and JC?
JC, I met, many years ago it was now. I was in Kansas City, and I was down there. I'd gotten involved in some real estate, rehabbing properties and flipping properties, and JC was doing some work for me, and we met through a third party who was part of that business. And we toyed around with putting together a trio of tenors, but it never really materialized at first till he showed me Marcus. We had a couple other guys that we sang with, rehearsed a few things. It was like, that's all right. But just wasn't feeling it. And he said to me one day, hey, I got this friend, Marcus Collins. He's busy. He's been in does small parts in films and musicals and things, and he's really busy. I don't know if he'd be interested. I said, well, show me a YouTube clip or something, you know. So he showed me a YouTube clip, and why are you holding out on me? Why didn't you tell me about this guy from the get-go? He's it. And so the three of us did a little performance for the Miss Kansas pageant. I had only spoken with Marcus over the phone and sent him music and his parts to learn. We rehearsed for about an hour, performed at the pageant, and then we haven't stopped since.
One thing they definitely haven't stopped on is helping others less fortunate. The Texas Tenors have sponsored over 600 children in the Child Fund International. They have worked to help kids in a Kansas City group called the Mission Project. Plus, they have sponsored the Homes for Our Troops organization. John reveals the impact that the show America's Got Talent has had on their career.
JC was well aware of it and liked the show and had been thinking about how unique it would be to put together a trio of tenors who tried to span virtually all genres of music. So that performance we did in Lawrence, we kind of did that. We sang several different genres. And those guys, having all the experience on the cruise ships, helped us get a little experience there. We decided after that performance in Kansas, we knew we were going to audition for America's Got Talent. We made a tape, sent it in. They gave us an audition time down in Houston. And, you know, we did that audition. And while we were going through that whole process, it started in May of 2009. And the process goes through September. You know, each round you get through, and the finals were in September. And while we were doing that, they used their connections in the cruise ship industry to get us some experience singing on cruise ships. So we were singing on the cruise ships. Then we would get off, go to a taping, go to Los Angeles for 5 or 6 days, take care of that business, go back to the cruise ship. We did 5 Alaskan cruises that summer, which was a great experience for us. And then it just grew from there. Once we got the exposure on TV, that show at that time was seen by over 100 million people around the world. It's shown in 60 countries. And that exposure helped get us interest, and people started contacting us, and it's grown into what it is today. You know, we've been able to take advantage of that and hit the ground running. We were always preparing for what might come up along the way. Throughout the show, we never put pressure on ourselves. We just said, let's go out and have a good time, and whatever happens, happens. But when we started getting inquiries about doing concerts, we had charts. I had experience singing with orchestras and knew people in that business. Those guys had other experiences. So collectively, our experiences helped us make inroads, and things went well, and we were able to take advantage of that and keep growing. So that's where we are.
So what was the ultimate effect of this America's Got Talent?
It's that exposure. You just cannot put a price tag on being seen by that many people and having an opportunity to connect. You know, you can be seen by that many people, but if you don't figure out how to connect with them, it isn't going to matter. Or if you can't move quick enough to take advantage of that 15 minutes, if you want to call it that. We've seen that happen to some of our friends where they were not able to make things happen fast enough to take advantage of that. We were fortunate. I think it's hard work, some luck. You know, it's just that things have to fall together. But we work awfully hard, probably too hard sometimes. You know, we keep trying to find that balance. But it's a labor of love for sure.
And after you went through this whole America's Got Talent, they provided you with a bonus.
We were part of a group show in Las Vegas in 2009. And then the show ended in September. And then we were part of a 10-week run of, I think it was 7 acts from the show in Las Vegas, which was really great exposure and invaluable experience, seeing how that world really works night after night. We would perform 6 shows a week. That was a great opportunity and a lot of fun.
Tell us about some of your creative projects in addition to your live concerts, because I'm sitting here looking at a stack of CDs and this book and CDs. So tell us about this.
Well, I tell you, that the hardest thing is trying to find time for some of that because we do so many shows. I think this year we're doing 166 shows, and 60 of them will be in Branson, but the other 100 plus are on the road. So it's hard to squeeze some of this in. But this past year, we did a book project. It's a children's book called Ruckus on the Ranch, which has been doing very well, and we're very proud of that, and it's been fun. We've been able to interact with lots of kids and get them involved in music. And we're working on another PBS special. We've just about got the music lined out for that. The orchestration's finished, and we'll be recording that in 2016, and it'll air in 2017 on public TV. And there'll be a companion CD with that. We're working on 2 different CDs. So it's just finding time to get in the studio is the biggest challenge.
Now tell us more about this first PBS special, and you have a DVD and a CD of that?
The first PBS special was shot in Phoenix, and we did that with the Phoenix Symphony at Grand Canyon University. The DVD from the show was only available by pledging through public television up until December 1st. So December 1st, it'll be available in stores and website and whatnot. The CD is not a direct companion, but it's most of the music from it, the You Should Dream CD, is from that special. And that can, I think that's at Barnes & Noble and Walmart. So for the next PBS special, there'll be a DVD again and a companion CD. And I am proud of, not just for myself, but of the group. You know, we won 3 Emmy Awards with our PBS special. We were the producers of it. And then I won an Emmy for arranging. And then Marcus was part of winning an Emmy for post-sound production. So we're very proud of that. And when it happened, we did that. We went and received our Emmys at the big banquet the one night. And then 12 hours later, we were doing a show. And then that, a few hours later, we were singing for Matthew McConaughey at a big awards ceremony, you know. And it's like, I didn't even get a chance to really absorb it. And I, to this day, I feel like I forget that we have it. It's, I have two of them sitting on my piano. I forget about it.
Congratulations. I'm happy for you guys.
Oh, we're just excited.
So, in addition to performing with the Des Moines Symphony Orchestra, you have this 3-bottle band. Tell us about these guys.
Well, we hooked up with these guys early on in Branson. They were the keyboard players, the music director for Bill Medley and the Righteous Brothers. And at that time, Bill Medley was doing shows at the same theater in Branson. And we worked out an arrangement to share the band. And we've never stopped. Bill doesn't perform near as much as he used to, so the band tours with us most of the time. And there's Tim Lee, who's been music director for Bill for almost 30 years now. Is Tim and Larry Hansen, who toured with Alabama for 20 seasons, are with us about 95% of the time, and they'll be in Des Moines with us. And they're just fantastic musicians and great people. And I remember sitting up late one night talking to Bill Medley about the band, how to put a band together, what to look for, all that kind of stuff. And he said, find the best people you can find and then make sure they can play. Make sure they're great musicians, but find good people. And Bill helped us do that by steering us to these two guys, and then we built around them. And we do. We have 5 really fantastic people who are fantastic musicians. And we're just a big, happy family. I know that sounds too good to be true, but it is. And touring is a lot of fun for us. And these guys are great players and great people.
So who else is bass and drums with you on this?
Ryan Hearn has been our drummer for 3 years now. And before working with us, he was playing for Andy Williams in Branson. And Marcus Willett is a bass player, and he also was playing for Andy Williams before working with us. And they have a lot of other experience playing for all kinds of people. And, you know, everybody is very schooled. Ryan went to North Texas State and has a great varied background in classical music as well, which really helps us out, because spanning everything from country to classical, we want somebody who understands both ends of the spectrum. And he's incorporated timpani into our show in Branson. His drum kit back there is so big, he's taken over the stage, but we love it.
So let's talk about the music that you perform and how you kind of started getting into this interesting mix.
Well, all 3 of us singers have a little bit different background. We all have some classical training, but I went that way and kind of stayed that way. Marcus and JC came up differently than I did, got some classical training, and then went off different directions. Marcus more in the Broadway pop area. JC's done a little bit of everything. He actually has done quite a bit of opera, but really loves country music and pop as well. And so we all have our likes and tastes, but it's amazing how easy it is for us, though, to agree on music. Because I think at the end of the day, we all like what we think is good music that has a message. And so it really doesn't matter the genre. You know, I appreciate a good pop melody if it has a great message, you know, that kind of thing. So we really, it's not hard for us to agree and pick out music. And it's been a real joy or a fulfilling thing to hear audience members after a show talk about how much they loved the variety and how maybe a fan who was a diehard country fan or the opposite, diehard classical fan, appreciated the other music, because I think it was good music in that genre. So I feel like we're stretching some people and maybe building an audience for each other.
So you're going to be at the Civic Center of Greater Des Moines on New Year's Eve.
Yes.
So tell us about some of the music people will hear.
Oh, we're going to do everything from Puccini to the Rolling Stones to John Denver to, I mean, we're going to do, it'll be a kind of a hit parade, but it's going to be a concert of inspiration. There's going to be a lot of great stuff. We'll do some of the things that people love. We always do Unchained Melody in our show. We'll be doing Ness and Dorma for those classical lovers, and there's going to be a real great mix of everything. And one of the things that I look forward to is surprising the audience with our rendition of Wild Horses by the Rolling Stones, which is always surprising to them, and they, it's always very, very well received. It's going to be a lot of fun stuff, and I'm very anxious to work with Maestro Junta. I had the opportunity and pleasure of being with him for one of the Iowa Network pledges for public TV. So we caught up a little bit, and I can remember him back when he was conductor here of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Symphony when I was just a kid. And in talking with him and speaking about that, realized that when I was a very young kid, I heard it was his first season here at Waterloo Cedar Falls. It was a concert that I was at. It was Robert Merrill, a great American baritone, who was singing with the symphony over at Waterloo West High School. And I was able to get, I think I was 10, something like that, was able to get Robert Merrill's autograph. And I still have that program. And I found it sometime after that public TV meeting and found it. And so there sure it is. You know, Maestro Junta, Joseph Junta, was the conductor. So I'm anxious to get Joe's autograph on that, to complete it. And Des Moines Symphony is a fantastic organization, and we're really looking forward to it. It's a really great symphony.
And the orchestra is going to do a few solo things, and you guys are going to do probably 90% of the show with the orchestra or with combo. So this sounds really fun.
Yeah, we'll be bringing four of our players with us. We'll have our rhythm section, a guitar player who also plays mandolin in that show, keyboard, drum, and the bass. And our bass player plays regular electric bass, but also plays an upright bass, too.
Iowa's own Texas tenor, John Hagen. The Des Moines Symphony's New Year's Eve's Pops, the Texas Tenors Concert, kicks off at 8 on Thursday night, December 31st at the Civic Center of Greater Des Moines. Tickets are available at Ticketmaster.com. For more information, please go to dmsymphony.org. To hear more from John Hagen's Texas Tenor interview, please go to the drop-down classical menu and click on the Iowa Art Showcase link on our website at iowapublicradio.org. While you're there, you can also check out all the holiday specials that Iowa Public Radio is broadcasting and also make your tax-deductible pledge at iowapublicradio.org. Today's December Iowa Art Showcase broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Program thanks for this show goes to James Marvel, Matthew Cauley, Robert Thomas, Janice Baker, Ellen Mullen, Bill Shepard, and John Hagen. Production thanks goes to Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner, Sean McLean, and WUOT. Operations thanks for this show also goes to IPR's Jason Burns and music director Al Scherz. Program research was provided by Rachel Berenger. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. Happy holidays, and thanks for joining us.